War for Guam tells the story of the experience and legacy of World War II in the island of Guam, which is a U.S. territory in the northwestern Pacific. What got me into making this film, actually, was a larger project that we could not complete, which was about the Spanish-American War. It was going to be a four-part series on the Spanish-American War and its legacy, and Cuba, Puerto Rico, Guam, and the Philippines. But we quickly saw that the Spanish-American War was a very difficult topic for funders in the U.S. because there's so little remembrance and recollection of this war, let alone its impact. So in time, what we decided to do was to concentrate on the two territories that were acquired during that period that were still U.S. territories, Guam and Puerto Rico, and in one of the legacies of the Spanish-American War, but resituating it in the 20th century, around the middle of the 20th century, which was the relationship between the territories and the military, the U.S. military.
It's part of a legacy that you're very familiar with, having written about, spend a lot of time, obviously, from Puerto Rico, and obviously Puerto Rico being one of those four colonial states, if you will, that were impacted so strongly by the Spanish-American War's aftermath. So tell us a little bit about your personal connection to these stories that you show in the film War for Guam, which sound so similar to some of the experiences we've seen on the island of Puerto Rico.
Yeah, obviously, the fact that I'm Puerto Rican and that I've devoted a lot of my career to studying Puerto Rico and its diaspora had a big impact on my interest in Guam. Interestingly, at the beginning, when I started researching the Spanish-American War, I became quickly familiar with what had happened in Cuba and the Philippines, which gets a lot of attention in the literature and in the film culture that we have on this particular war. But then for a long time, I would read and not find any references to Guam. And then all of a sudden, there was a reference to Guam. And then I became extremely curious about what had happened in Guam, because it seemed like as the fate of Guam and Puerto Rico and the trajectory that we share. So I started to get more interested, and then I visited Guam. And at the beginning, I had the sensation that the people of Guam were like the Puerto Ricans of the Pacific, you know, that we had so many things in common. But the more I went to Guam, I also realized that we do have a lot of things in common in terms of our trajectories. We were both possessions of Spain, later of the U.S. But that instance of being occupied by Japan actually created a number of differences between the two spaces. And I became as interested in the things that we shared as the things that we did not share, because that comparison allowed me to think further about Guam, but also about Puerto Rico.
Well, let's get into some of that. Let's talk a little bit about the Chamorros, first of all, the people that were impacted by these different occupations that occurred, the expectations that came with the arrival of the United States during the war, and then eventually the disappointment that occurred subsequent to that when they realized that their territory was essentially being usurped and controlled by a foreign power once again.
Yeah, I mean, in that regard, there's definitely a shared experience of disappointment, but how the events unfolded are a little different. So, for instance, in Puerto Rico, people were aware that this war was coming and positioned themselves in relation to the war. Initially, many Puerto Ricans, including sectors of the elite, but also people at large, saw the U.S. invasion as a possibility that might remove a regime that was oppressive and that it would open up democracy and modernity for the island. Whereas in Guam, when the U.S. Naval captain arrives in Guam to take the island on his way to the Philippines, which was his ultimate destination, the people in Guam, including the Spanish governor of the island, did not know that Guam or the U.S. or Spain was at war. So they were surprised to find themselves confronting an American ship that was bombing the island. They thought it was a salute. And it wasn't until they met the captain explained, no, actually, we're at war and I'm taking this island for the United States, that they realized what had happened. Now, the unlike Puerto Rico also, there wasn't an American force for a year in Guam. So there was an entire year that Guam was on its own, let's say. And once the U.S. comes, however, there are the commonalities begin. So in both cases, you have a military government that becomes that was imposed. And in both places, there is a response against that military government. So in Guam, although people tend to think that resistance to the military in Guam is a recent phenomenon, one of the things that we learned making the film, that actually that wasn't true, that immediately that the people of Guam were confronted with the military government, they knew that that was not right. And they started to petition the U.S. to extend to them citizenship and to remove the military government. And at the time, the majority of people that lived in Guam, which had a population of about 10, 12,000 people, were native Chamorro people. And I mentioned that because the demographics of Guam today, to a large extent, because of the military presence and its impact on the island, has shifted dramatically. So Chamorros today make about 37% of the population, rather than 90-some percent in the 1890s.
Was there, and again, Puerto Rico, bigger population and much considerable resistance to the U.S. Presence. Could you talk about the people that you spoke to, the stories that you tell in the film, War for Guam, and how they perhaps represent some of that that level of resistance and discomfort with U.S. With the U.S. presence?
Well, the feelings that the Chamorro people have towards the military, I think one would have to say two things. One, that they've shifted some through time, and two, that they become more vocal over time. And that has a lot to do with World War II. So early on, before the war, there were these petitioners, there was this discomfort, there were constant demands on the military to create a different kind of government and to the U.S. government. In fact, there were two Chamorros that traveled all the way from Guam to Washington, D.C. to hand in this petition to the governor, to the government. So there were all these attempts to do so, but by and large, the majority of people were living somewhat aloof from the military. The military, it's an irony that at the time, the military viewed the entire island of Guam as a ship and tried to govern it as a ship, but they didn't really interfere that much with the majority of people's everyday life. Whereas after the war, where there is an extension of citizenship and there is a civilian governor and government that eventually replaced the military government, the military actually has more control over all aspects of Guam. So it's one of the ironies. But in the after World War II period, basically the crisis comes in, where the military comes back and thinks that they will restore their authority and become the government of Guam again, as if the war had not happened. And that was very impossible to happen at that time, because the people of Guam had endured a nearly three-year occupation, an extremely harsh occupation under the Japanese, and felt that they had already more than proven that they were loyal Americans and that they deserved to be treated with a civilian government and with citizenship rights. And then added to that experience of the war was the immediate process of dispossession of land that took place, through which the U.S. Military took away about three-quarters of the landmass of Guam from the Chamorro people to build military bases and sometimes to build recreational facilities and other things that were not essential, let's say, to national security. So the combination of the war experience and the disposition of land created the conditions for Chamorro people to not accept at all the idea that military government was coming back to Guam. And at the same time, you see that critical position towards the military becomes more radical over time, because the generation that lived through the war, despite having this critique of what had happened with the U.S. military's return, they also had a feeling of gratitude towards the U.S. military, because the Japanese had brought together the majority of Chamorros into concentration camps and had started killing people in anticipation that they had lost the war, and this was very humiliating. And they saw the Chamorros as having never really sympathized with them and always remained loyal to the U.S. So there was a lot of anger towards the Chamorros from the Japanese military. So the generation that was in the concentration camps and the generation that saw their siblings or their parents killed also had that ambivalence towards the military. So on the one hand, many were critical of the land dispossession, but on the other hand, they were very thankful that the Marines and the Army had come and rescued them from what seemed to be imminent death.
Just quickly, I know the films about the people, the Chamorros, and the impact that this U.S. And Japanese and militarization of the island has had on the people. But if you can just, I'm not sure if the film focuses on or at least expresses what Guam represents for the United States in terms of strategic interests, in terms of its imperial approach to the Pacific region. Does the film explore any of that, considering that all of these enterprises, Philippines, Cuba, Puerto Rico, they all had to do with U.S. expansion of its military might around the world?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the first part of the film alludes to why the U.S. Military is interested in Guam to begin with, which has to do with naval technology at the time that needed these coaling stations in between certain amount of distance. And in the broader sense, because they felt that they needed to have these bases in order to be a world power country and access and be able to have a presence in the Pacific and Asian region. Then that importance of Guam actually grows over time. And in the third part of the film, we look more closely at the impact of that, because after the war, you are also in the thick of the Cold War, and then the fact that Guam is in this region where there are communist governments that the U.S. fears and is in tension with, and that includes South Korea, Vietnam, China, the Soviet Union, now give Guam a greater prominence, which is one of the reasons that then Guam gets really militarized at a level that it actually hadn't been before, even though the whole island of Guam was seen as a U.S. ship, you know? So definitely, the role and the way that the U.S. views Guam instrumentally as a space in their, you know, larger project of military and political control of certain parts of the world, it's very much part of the story. And in fact, I think towards the end of the film, I mean, one of the critical questions is, the Chamorro people for about 120 years and other people that live in Guam really have next to no say in what takes place on Guam as it pertains to its economy, to its land use, and even at the level of employment, where the military pretty much is one of the major employers of the island. So it's impossible, nearly impossible, for people in Guam to live autonomously from the military.
Okay, well, I'm going to leave it at that. We've been speaking with Frances Negron Muntaned, who is an award-winning filmmaker. She's a writer, scholar, author of a number of books, and she's the producer-director of a new film, which is making its rounds on broadcast television over the next month or so. It's called War for Guam, and we're going to give more details on it later on. Frances Negron Muntaned, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you so much, Mario.